Good morning, family. It seems like it has been quite a while since we've been together like this, and but I've stood before you, I believe, right before our shutdown last week. Thank you for your patience as we were trying to make a difficult call with the potential weather coming in and all that. We're glad that it came to nothing, but on the other hand, sad not to be together. The week before that, Tyler preached to us the message coming into Epiphany about the Magi from the East coming in and the lessons we learned from that, which is actually a good segue into what we're going to be looking at starting this morning. And that is, as you can see on the screen, starting of a series on the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, let me just say, I will keep saying probably Ezekiel. For some reason, Ezekiel is stuck in my head. So if I say Ezekiel, I mean Ezra. I'll try to correct that as we go along, but we're going to look at what I'm calling actually the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, as I believe the book, the two were actually in the Jewish scriptures, one book. They were later separated, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, but I really do believe it's one literary work, and so it's what I'm calling, and you can use this as kind of a three-stage episodes as you go through the book. It basically is broken down into three sections: the temple, the law, and the wall, as led as by the book names Ezra and Nehemiah. And what we're going to look at this morning is a prologue. And so I'm coming into this recognizing, you know, you come into something like this and it's like we want to worship and we're here and we're singing and now we're going to get a history class. Sometimes history classes don't seem very worshipful, but I think it's necessary because we realize these books are thousands of years old, written in at least two other ancient languages. And it's a history that many of us are not deeply embedded in and really familiar with. So it's just necessary, I think, for a prologue to understand. As if you missed the Sunday school, please go back and view that. It's so helpful just to even ask questions about many of the things that we're going to be looking at over the next several weeks in regards to the fulfillment of prophecy and the place of Israel and the Jews and so on. And so these things take place in history. What we read and what we read there in Psalm 137, that shocking end line of blessed are those who dash your little ones on the rocks are born out of a prayer and an angst because they had themselves seen their little ones literally, physically, not just spiritually. You know, we say, oh, our little ones are being dashed on the rocks of our culture. You know, that's not what was going on in these days. When Jerusalem is overthrown, when they are taken into captivity, it is a horrific event, as you can read in the book of Lamentations, as you can read, and as I've just been reading in Jeremiah and Ezekiel recently, I meant Ezekiel that time, that these are horrific historical events. And likewise, coming into Ezra and Nehemiah, these are historical events that actually took place, and I think it's a temptation when we read in our devotional literature or in our devotional time to come to these books as like kind of spiritual books, like what are the spiritual lessons I learned with in bypassing in the process the fact that these are things that actually happen to real people like us with children like us going through really hard things in normal life and trying to feed their family and so on. So let's begin together to look at the book of Ezra Nehemiah. First of all, I want to make some comments on studying Hebrew narrative. We have been over the past couple of years, primarily in the New Testament. We finished up the book of Matthew sometime back. We looked at the book of 1 Peter to think about being exiles in this day and age. We looked at the book of James. It's a very practical early Christian letter. We've been focusing in the New Testament, and so as we as pastors began to talk and pray, we thought it'd be good to kind of get back into some of a big picture, what did God do in the Old Testament? What does it have to do with us? A bit of a diversion, if you will. But Hebrew narrative is just a whole nother thing than what we find in New Testament epistles or letters. There's a certain way to read it. There's a certain way to think about it. There's a certain way to approach it. And so I want to mention some helpful points, I hope, as we come to Hebrew narrative. And I find myself here just the challenge of taking on Ezra and Nehemiah as a singular book of Hebrew Old Testament narrative, which has its own rules, and doing what now strikes me as a little odd, which is to turn it into sermons. It's like taking a genre of literature that is completely different in one genre and changing it and teaching it in a whole different way than it was actually written and intended. For some reason, that just particularly strikes me strange this time. That for thousands of years, these scriptures would have been read in the synagogues. They would have been talked about among the Jewish people. The children would have asked questions. They would have engaged on it. And now I'm going to attempt to take this wonderful piece of literature and turn it into a sermon. Does that strike anybody as odd? It just does me this time. But it's the challenge of not just using the scripture. And Eugene Peterson talks about this all the time, of how we like co-opt the Bible. What is my job as a pastor? Well, it's to get up on Sunday morning and preach a sermon. Okay, so now I'm going to the Bible for sermonic material to turn it into something that I can use and make practical and help, shape the church into the shape that I want it to be. And Peterson, I think, rightly warns of that. Now, what we should first do, and even what a sermon should do, and sermons may even take on some of the shape of the kind of books they're dealing with, but it's taking the Bible on its own terms and understanding it the way it was written. And the way that Ezra and Nehemiah was written was as a singular narrative with these cycles in it that we'll see over time to give a very specific message, because remember, all of this is assembled and put together after the fact. This isn't a journal history of what's going on. It is somebody or some group of people sitting down and assembling this book with specific agenda in mind. This is what we want our people to know. This is what we want them to remember. It's not as exhausting as it can be reading through some of these accounts. It's not exhaustive in its content. The author or the compilers are assembling their material, choosing and leaving some things out, putting it together for a very specific agenda. And so it's one of the challenges of doing Old Testament exegesis, particularly in narrative, like what were they trying to accomplish with this? And let's not do something other than that. Let's figure out what that is. We remember that a book like Ezra and Nehemiah, or even any book of the Bible, is first and foremost, as Tyler mentioned in the morning hour, a multi-genre literary work. That Ezra is not James or 1 Peter. Ezra is not Matthew. Ezra is not the Psalms. It's not trying to accomplish and do the same thing. It is its own rules, its own genre written, and it's, as I've already mentioned, written in history. So it has a very specific historical orientation and not something like a psalm that kind of is often lifted out of history and made universal in some way for the follower of God. So as I've already mentioned, there's a strange task of turning a literary work into a sermon. It's a bit of a challenge. So when we come to Ezra and Nehemiah, we're going to be asking questions about the intent of the original writers. Why did they include the material they did? Why did they put it in the order that they did? Why are these repeated patterns? Why do they leave out certain things? What are they hoping to accomplish? What is their purpose in writing? If we don't get to that, then we're just kind of using it for like devotional material to get some, principles for leadership or something like that, which, by the way, I don't think is the primary goal of Ezra and Nehemiah as much as it's used in Christian circles for that. The books are multitudinous of leadership principles from Ezra and Nehemiah. Footnote, I don't think that's the point of the books. So I'm showing my hand a little bit there. So it is a challenge then to find their shape, in this case, the cycles of these ancient stories that are similar, but yet also have even in the way that they are told, they're making a point and progressing through this literary work. And particularly when you get to the end, and spoiler alert, it's a big disappointment. You get to the end and you're like, is that it? Is that it? And this is, by the way, the end of Old Testament history. This is where Old Testament history ends. This is the last narrative. This is you've got the prophetic books like Malachi and others that are written after this time, but Ezra is actually the end of the story for the Old Testament. And so you have Ezra, Nehemiah, at the end, it ends, and everybody's disappointed. Everybody's scratching their heads. Everybody's saying, what's that all about? And then you got nothing until Matthew 1, all right, for 400 years. So there's this important approach of a theological reading, not merely history, what happened, but theological reading is what was God doing, all right? And what are we supposed to take away from it? And unlike a sermon, most Old Testament narrative books don't get to the end and say, now, boys and girls, the lesson of the story in five applications is this. That's what we do in sermons. It's not what you do with stories, at least not good ones. You are supposed to sense and feel and come away knowing the meaning of it without being told. That's just called sermonizing, which is what I do. So as a unified literary work, Ezra and Nehemiah, there's this important connectedness within itself, but there's also this huge point of importance that also Tyler mentioned a good bit this morning of the interconnectedness. It's what one person has called hyperlinking. That the more we get to know our Bibles, the content of the Bibles, of the references, its self-referential orientation, how either explicitly, like as the prophet said, or implicitly, where there are these themes and these ideas that seem to resonate. The Bible is, as Jordan Peterson puts it, the most hyperlinked book in all of human history. And to get an idea of this, somebody somewhere did this. Thank you. This is some sort of physical, graphical, illustrative presentation of how hyperlinked the Bible is with itself. So it's not just a story, and that's kind of what the cross references in your Bible shows you, at least to some degree. But this shows that there's this interconnectedness and interplay. So even Ezra and Nehemiah is both referencing things that have come before. And sometimes it's like this was spoken of by the prophet Ezra. It's that explicit. Sometimes it's the use of a phrase that we often miss in the English, but is found in the Hebrew that is repeated over and over. And the Hebrew here would hear that phrase over and over and over. And they're like, oh, this means something, and then they recognize it maybe from the book of Genesis or the book of Numbers or something like that. Or they have been so immersed in the prophets, they don't mention the prophet, but they know that's a direct fulfillment of a phrase that was used with one of the prophets. So this just shows this interconnectedness. The better we know our Bibles over the years, and even, you know, here's January. If you haven't started yet, here's a good idea to start some sort of Bible reading plan where you systematically, methodically, regularly move through the Bible at your own pace, but do that. Because accumulating this over 10, 20, 30, 40 years has long-term benefits that you don't get in the morning-by-morning reading because you start getting a sensibility about it. And by the way, any good story also, just because you know the ending, a well-written story you can go back and read again, and the ending doesn't spoil it. It just makes it richer because you know what's coming. That point also made by C.S. Lewis. He also said that any good children's book, if it is a really great story, is best enjoyed probably by adults. So juvenile literature is not just for juveniles. So here's this interconnectedness. So we need to pay attention to that in Ezra, Nehemiah. So here we go. This is the story so far, briefly. We have in Genesis the creation story, God creating the world, the fall of Adam and Eve, the flood in judgment of human sin and the human race, the Tower of Babel in attempt to raise up and become their own gods once again and accomplish their own purposes. Then we have the call of Abraham, who is called out of paganism to be a special person. Remember, he wasn't Hebrew, Jewish. You know, that he is the beginning of this thing. God calls him out of paganism. He calls him out of Ur of the Chaldees, and then his sons, Isaac and Jacob, the patriarchs. There is a story of these promises made to Abraham to make of him a great nation, and the nations will be blessed in him, and he will receive a land, and he will have a people that are more numerous than the stars of the sky and the sands of the beaches. Then from Isaac and Jacob, Jacob's name is changed to Israel. He has sons, the 12 tribes of Israel, and then one of the other sons, Joseph, and his multicolored coat. He saves his brothers from certain demise despite their treachery of him and selling him into slavery in his years in prison. And you come then to the book of Genesis or Exodus, and the nation is brought into Egypt for safety. They are eventually made slaves. They're there some 430 years. And you have the main character, which appears to be the silent God, who's just not doing anything by all appearances, who's not saying anything, who's not revealing himself. And he's just not acting, but he hears their cries, we're told, in the book of Exodus. And then out of the enslavement, you have Moses, who is raised up. He's saved from the waters. He is taken to a far country. He grows up there. Grows up in Egypt, gets old there on the other side of the mountains. He comes back as the rescuer, redeemer of his people, and God shows miracles through him, brings the plagues, rescues Israel from Egypt, destroys Pharaoh and his army in the Red Sea. And then they go and don't believe the Lord, don't have faith. They follow the false counsel of the bad spies, and they go into wilderness for 40 years. And there in the wilderness, a whole new generation is raised up who eventually come in through in the books of Joshua and Judges. They come into the conquest. They begin to destroy the surrounding nations. They come in and implant themselves, but they begin to do what is right in their own eyes. They don't fulfill the commission. Judges are raised up to rescue them from their oppressors. And then they go back and forth and back and forth, and things get very ugly. And then finally, they cry out for a king like the nations, and through Samuel the prophet, who's the little boy, who is the promised child of Hannah, who goes to the temple to pray, Samuel is raised up. He's made a new prophet priest. He comes and he anoints Saul to be a king like the nations. Saul fails monumentally, but God chooses a man after his own heart who will have his own problems, but David then becomes the central figure of the rest of the Old Testament and the central figure next to Jesus in the fulfillment of the promises. After the time of David, Solomon, his son, reigns. He builds the great temple in Jerusalem. He gets old. He is himself unfaithful. He has two sons, Rehoboam and Jeroboam. They fight over the kingdom. The kingdom is then divided into the northern Israel, southern Judah kingdom with Samaria and Jerusalem as their capitals. They disobey the Lord. They do what is right in their own eyes. They receive the curses of God. And finally, Assyria comes in and destroys the northern kingdom, who are the ones who have descended down from Rehoboam. And the northern kingdom falls. Samaria falls in 722 BC. And then finally, the southern kingdom falls with the capital of Jerusalem and the two primary remaining Judah and Benjamin, those tribes. And in 586, Babylon comes in, destroys Jerusalem, and they are all taken into exile. Excuse me, one second here. So that's the story so far. Does that ring any bells? Okay. So that's where we are. So where we are is this history of God's promises and what he's doing, putting them into the land. They're unfaithful, unfaithful, unfaithful. God finally says, in judgment against your sins, he first overthrows the northern part of the divided kingdom. He most devastatingly overthrows Jerusalem, which is Mount Zion, which is the city of David, which is the city of God, which has the temple in it with his worship and his sacrifices and the sacrificial system and the priests. That all is completely dismantled, and they're taken into Babylon. And then they live in exile in Babylon. That's where we get Psalms like Psalm 137. By the waters of Babylon, we hung up our harps, we cried. They said, sing us some of the songs of Jerusalem. Sing us some of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of Zion in a foreign land? And so they are there lamenting. And so there's the big question. And by the way, here's a great video. If you'll go look at the Bible Projects, the theme or the topic is exile. It is some of the struggle of what it meant for them to live in exile. But I'll just refer you to that. So that's where they are, is they are in exile. What Ezra and Nehemiah then, picking up on that story, is them coming back to the land. That's Ezra and Nehemiah. them coming back to the land in the fulfillment of the promises of God that he gave through Jeremiah, that he gave through Isaiah, which he gave through other prophets, that they would come back. And the question is, this is kind of, let's see how this goes. Was 70 years approximately in exile sufficient to teach Israel the lesson that they needed to bring about the kingdom? Was that enough? I gave you the land, you didn't use it well, you have sinned, I'm kicking you out now, letting you live under somebody else's dominion, just like back in Egypt. Wink, wink, there's a hyperlink. There's a lot of parallels, as we'll see, of this coming from exile back into the land with Egypt and the Exodus. There's an intentional literary parallel with what God is doing. But now the question is, have you learned your lesson? And if not, how long is this going to take? How many times do we have to do this? Or is there going to need to be another solution to fix this problem? That's one of the big questions coming in. All right, okay. So here's a little nerdy nerd stuff, all right? People, those of you who are aspiring cartographers, isn't that it? Map makers? Yes, thank you, John, for affirming that. So here's some nerdy nerd stuff. What you'll find is, as you look there, you can see the green with the red around it. Bottom left-hand side, you have the well-known Dead Sea, Jordan River, the Sea of Galilee up there at the top, and you see where Jerusalem is, and what we call Palestine is that general area. Now, what you have here is the Assyrian Empire, a map of, roughly speaking, the Assyrian Empire. If you want to remember the chronology of those kingdoms in the Old Testament, the kingdoms, not the nations, but the kingdoms that Israel deals with, remember just ABC. Jim Sebastio, pastor of RBC, Louisville, taught me this many, many years ago. But if you want to remember this segment, you just ABC. Assyria, Babylon, and Cyrus, which isn't a kingdom, but we'll see he represents the kingdom of Persia. So ABC, Assyria, Babylon, and the big guy in Babylon is Nebuchadnezzar. And then you have Cyrus, who is with Persia. So here's phase one. This is what the kingdom in government looks like when the northern kingdom, Samaria, northern kingdom of Israel, falls. It's under the Assyrian Empire. And so you can see there's the Fertile Crescent, which follows the Euphrates and Tigris River. This is such an arid, dry place. You've got, notice, desert down south there. Without water, you got nothing but desert in this area. So the Fertile Crescent is important for growing, for agriculture, for civilization. The first civilizations, as far as we can tell, grew up around Egypt and the delta there coming up in northern Egypt because of the water and the fertility, and then also the Tigris River moving down into Sumer. As far as we can track it, those are some of the earliest human civilization and kingdoms as they gather together in what we would call more city rather than nomadic lifestyles. So the Fertile Crescent, then you've got the Assyrian kingdom that is there from all the way down to Jerusalem. But notice what's not included is Asia Minor or any of Greece or Egypt. Those are completely separate. And you've got it over to the Zagros Mountains. That's where you are down to the Persian Gulf. Okay, so that's a pretty significant kingdom. That's the kingdom that comes and overthrows the northern kingdom of Israel itself. That's stage A, Assyria. Stage B, Babylon, is now under Nebuchadnezzar and other leaders, is significantly expanded. Now you've got all the way down moving into Egypt. You've got moving up into Asia Minor as far as Tarshish. You've moved up to that Tigris River. And now you're moving out to the empire of Elam down by the Persian Gulf. So it's not expanded a great deal, but it's significantly larger. Babylon overthrows Syria. And when they do that, now they take in all of the captives of the northern kingdom, and Babylon comes in and overthrows the southern kingdom. I know it's a lot. Hang in there with me. This is just the prologue, remember? So Babylon comes in, they overthrow Jerusalem, they devastate the city, they destroy the temple, and now the Israelites, by and large, not all of them, but by and large, the aristocrats, the people of the kingdom of the descendants of David, anybody with money, they basically leave the poor people of the land in Jerusalem, in Judea, in that area, because they know that where land and cities aren't inhabited, wild animals come in and just completely take it over. So they don't want that to happen. So they leave the poor among the land. They take all of the richer people into captivity. And you can see there the Chebar or the Chebar Canal down southeast of Babylon. It's in that area, probably the majority of the Jews are taken. We're talking about millions of people who are displaced, walked up around the Fertile Crescent and displaced. And Babylon's idea was, well, this squelches rebellion. Because you have all of the leaders and all of the wealth, you remove that from them, you take them and you put them where you can keep close watch over them. The poor people, the peasants, they don't have the smarts or the ability or the resources to resource and fund an army. Therefore, you displace the aristocracy, you displace the kings, you displace the people, keep them under watch, and many times they would just take them there and kill them. So it was also a wiping out of a tremendous amount of the leadership of the Jews as well. So that's the Babylonian. That's phase two. But now notice you have down to the southeast, Elam, in the place of Susa, right above the Persian Gulf. Then you've got this thing called the Median Empire. Right? That's pretty substantial. Then you move over to Asia Minor and you see Lydia. Okay, and these are separate kingdoms, separate cultures, separate governments. But now you have something interesting that happens is the Median Empire joins together with Elam, which becomes Persia, which is modern day Iran, and it becomes the Medo-Persian Empire from Medo from Median from that. The Persia, Medo-Persian, which eventually just becomes the Persian Empire. And then you'll have something very dramatic takes place under one of the primary characters of Ezra, Nehemiah. And that is this amazing thing that has fascinated me to no end called the Persian Empire. So we're now in Assyria, Babylon, now we're Persia, which is the letter C for Cyrus. Now we come to Cyrus the Great, one of the most fascinating characters I've personally gotten into in recent days. This is the backdrop. If you want to understand Ezra and Nehemiah, this is the only way to understand it, I think. We come with someone called Cyrus the Great, who's actually Cyrus the Second. He's the second, but he becomes the Great because of what he does with the uniting the Medo-Persian. He's born essentially in the Zagros Mountains. He has this interesting upbringing. He has a grandfather and a father who are kings within that kingdom. And there's a prophecy that he's going to be the one who actually becomes the greater king of them. Dad and grandpa don't like that, so they have him killed, or they think they have him killed. The person that they give him to expose him, meaning leaving him out in the open, is a shepherd, according to the story. And the shepherd has just, his wife has just had a miscarriage. And so he adopts this son, Cyrus, as his own, saves his life, changes his name, and eventually he's the one that rises up and overthrows his father and grandfather. That's just a cool story. And becomes the greatest ruler of all history up to this point, only to be exceeded by later Alexander the Great and then eventually the Roman Empire. But this is a really fascinating point of history. So here's Cyrus the Great. He's the third king of Anshan, again, modern-day Iran. He assumes the throne after he grows up around 559 BC after revolting against his grandfather and father. The prophecy was right. He actually overthrew them. So then, and if you remember on that map, there was that far, what we call modern-day Turkey, Lydia, which was a major, substantial empire that had a huge sea fleet and was its own. Well, people had come against them for a long time. You just could not overcome Lydia. They have a campaign against Lydia and take all of Asia Minor. It's remarkable. Then they start moving to the east. and they go into China and into India, and to in India as far as the Indus Valley. And we're going to see a map of how massive this is and how much bigger than Assyria, Babylon. It is incredibly impressive. And as we'll see, it's incredibly impressive how he did it. It wasn't displacement, murder, killing, taking over, keeping watch. It's a policy, by and large, of generosity that gains him favor of the largest kingdom in human history up to this point. He then sets himself, at this point, remember, that Medo-Persian Empire is riding above Babylon at this point when they go and take Lydia, they go and go into India, and now the Babylonian Empire geographically sits underneath them, like they are on top of them, like this, you know? So he sets himself against the Babylonian Empire, which is the most powerful empire of human civilization up to this point. It seems to be no small task, but it's actually pretty easy. Because Cyrus, by and large, is a good guy. Babylon, their ruler at the time, post-Nebuchadnezzar, the ruler, and I don't remember his name right now, but they've got an oppressive ruler in Babylon who's taxing people and hurting people and has just become this monstrosity. And when Cyrus shows up to the city of Babylon, the priests are on his side, the priests in Babylon. They're like against the ruler, and he is viewed not as a conqueror, but as a liberator. I mean, that's the way you want to come into a place. When you're viewed as the good guy who've come to liberate us, you've got a lot of influence and a lot of control. And he takes over the city of Babylon and inherits instantly the entire Babylonian Empire. So now you've got the entire Medo-Persian Empire in almost a day have all of Babylon. Now you've got the Persian Empire, which is the largest by far, by 2 to 3 times, of all of human history up to this point. He literally becomes the ruler of the whole known world at this point and begins to proclaim himself the king of all other kings. That's not a claim to deity. It is to say that all of the empires which I rule over, I am the king in the hierarchy of all of the other kings. All that remains at this point is Egypt, which at one point was a world power, and Greece, which is its whole other thing with what will come at Marathon, with what will come at the hot gates with the 300 and the Grecian league of people who will fight against. And I went and rewatched 300. Remember the bad guy? He's from Persia. What's interesting is 300, and the story is told by Herodotus, who is a Greek. So, of course, Persia is the bad guy. So some really fascinating stories. He was not nearly as much of a monstrosity as Xerxes, that is, as he appears. But that's like making the bad guys all wear black hats and black suits, and, you know, they talk with the draw, and they have snakeskin boots. And, you know, they're just the bad of the bad. Well, that's not the Persian perspective at all. But that's a whole other story with what happens with Greece. It's a fascinating part of the story, but that comes later. But to spoil it, he does take Egypt, or Persia eventually will take Egypt and Greece, which is an unbelievable task of what will happen. But that will happen after Ezra and Nehemiah. So here's what makes Cyrus in particular fascinating and important to the story that we're going to be reading in Ezra and Nehemiah. He, unlike any known ruler before him and not very many after him, has a policy that when he takes over a new kingdom, all of the exiles in that kingdom that are from other places, he sends them home. And he pays the bills to send them home. And he says, "Who's your God? Was your temple destroyed? And if it was, I'm going to pay to get your temple rebuilt and reestablished when I send you back home." Never had that been seen before. The way you showed the supremacy of your God was by tearing down, like, we got the right God, we've got the right gods, because Your temple is in shambles. Your temple has been torn to pieces. Therefore, we're superior. Cyrus establishes a religious tolerance policy, and not only tolerance, but support, and says, I'm going to send you back. And we're going to see in Ezra, he actually takes all of the monetary items, well, you know, valuable items that have been taken by Babylon and put into the treasury of the king Nebuchadnezzar. He gives them all of their stuff back and funds the entire temple project. Now, what's also fascinating is he doesn't just do this with the Jews. He does it with every single people group within his kingdom who submits to him. So he sends them back wholesale, begins to send them back in waves. We know there are two major returns that we find in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. He funds the rebuilding of worship centers and encourages local culture and customs. He's like, you don't have to be Persian. Assyria came and said, you have to be Assyrian. Babylon came along, you have to be Babylonian. Cyrus comes along and says, you be whoever you are. Alexander will come and say, you must be Greek. Rome will come along and say, we're going to put up with this a little bit, but you better obey Rome. There's a huge amount of tolerance in Cyrus. Now, I don't want to over-romanticize it, but compared to other ancient leaders, it's remarkable. So what we have is in 539 BC, the specific decree of Cyrus that enables the return of the Jewish exiles to Judah. But again, they're not the only one on the books. He's doing this with this graciously with all of the people. Now we come to the final map here. That square represents the size of what the map previous to this, basically. So that's how, now you can see how much larger this is, even the map. Remember the previous map? Only part of it was colored. Not only is all of that taken except for the Arabian Desert, but who wants that? But now, take that square away. Now they've got into Lydia, and they've moved up into Thrace, and right below that is Greece. Like, they are knocking at your door, Grecians. And they will eventually take over Egypt. This is a little bit later map. But then you have all the way over to the Indus River, the Indus Valley, and you have moved up there by the Aral, past the Caspian in the Aral Sea. This is the Persian Empire at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. It is massive. Nothing's ever been seen like it before. All right. So a little bit about the Persians then. What do we make of these folks? What we find in the Persians is a very interesting mix of various cultures that are both Near Eastern and Far Eastern. Because remember, they've got engagement with India, they've got engagement with China, they've got engagement with the Arabian Peninsula, they've now got engagement with Egypt and Lydia, and now Greece. So this is the most multicultured kingdom that has ever existed in the world up to this period. So they have a very rich cultural heritage. They're not trying to colonize, if you will, everybody and make them exactly like they are. They appreciate the cultural diversity. Because under this king's reign, the more people and the diversity of the people shows his greatness. It's not uniformity that shows his greatness, but diversity under his kingdom that shows he's the king of kings. Now, one of the interesting things that also happens has to do with the religion. Now, as you know, most ancient religions are either henotheistic, which means it believes in a localized god of this particular area, but that tribe had this god, this tribe had this god. So it wasn't polytheistic in that you worshipped all of the gods, but rather you had your local god. There was the god of, you know, the Greeks of this particular area. There was the god of this. There was the god of water, Neptune. There was the god, you know, the god of the council, which is like Zeus. And so you have these different gods, but they work in different spheres. The idea of monotheism, like strict monotheism, you have essentially in the Jews, and then you also have in Zoroastrianism. Now, Zoroastrianism is a bit of a mystery because we don't know exactly when it started, but it's definitely the dominant religion of the Persian Empire. Now, obviously, they're not requiring everybody to do this because they're encouraging diversity within the kingdom. But Zarathustra in the Greek form is Zoroaster, was some sort of a proclaimed prophet who believed that there was one God. And again, this is very unusual in the ancient world. And one God over heaven and earth. And eventually it developed from a monotheism into to kind of a dualism. And the dualism is that there's, as he wrestled with the idea that God is God of all, he looked into the world and saw suffering and misery and darkness and death and all of this and said, can this come directly from the hand of a God who is good? And so he develops over time, or claims he has revealed to him, that there are basically two deities, which sounds contradictory to monotheism. I know it's a little complicated, but you have the good God, Ahura Mazda. So with those of you driving a Mazda, you're tipping your hat to Zoroastrianism, whether you realize it or not. But Ahura Mazda is the God of light and goodness and blessing. There's no darkness in him. He is absolutely good. And everything that is good comes from him. Then you have Angira Mainyu, who is like the opposite, darkness. He's kind of a demon, Satan figure. And there's this cosmic clash between the two. And he basically says, look, anything that is good and that comes from good is from Ahura Mazda. Anything that is dark from the evil one is from Angira Mainyu. And so then there's the question. And then in their Zoroastrian story, they're almost equal powers, which is very different than Christianity and Judaism, by the way. But they're almost equal powers, but light has just enough of an upper hand that eventually in the end, that Mazda will overcome. Now, in this time period, they also believed in a judgment day and a heaven and hell and resurrection from the dead, which by and large the Jews had not yet theologically fully accepted yet. So they believed that there was a judgment day, that there was a narrow bridge over which you cross and are judged. And if you have good deeds, good thoughts, good works, and they outmeasured your bad deeds and bad works, you would go to heaven, a post-life paradise, if you will. And if you did evil, said evil, thought evil, then you were on the side of darkness and you would suffer. This is the religion that is the dominant religion while Israel is in exile. That's just a statement of fact. I have to wonder, as I'll come to at the end, I have to wonder to what degree the Jews, while in Babylon, or while in Babylon and eventually Persia before their return, to what degree they're engaging with these theological discussions, and God is using that to help them think through some stuff even in their own scriptures. We don't know for sure, but this was the dominant thing that they would be hearing at that time period. Moving on with Persia. Persia had a standing and marching army of 300,000 people. They could call that army to stand up and march. And by the way, they built before the Roman roads were built along the Fertile Crescent or above the Fertile Crescent. They built the first international road from Persia all the way over to Lydia. Because anybody you want to rule, you better be able to get to pretty quickly. 300,000 for a standing army was astronomical. The logistics behind feeding and clothing and caring for 300,000 is nearly unbelievable. And they will go into Asia Minor. They will fight against the Greek League of Nations and try to overcome them and overtake them. So that's something that 300 kind of gets right. They give the number, and Herodotus gives the number 1,000,000. But if you're fighting an enemy and you want to show just how great you are against this overwhelming force, you tend to inflate the numbers. So it'd be easy to go from 300,000. This was a 1,000,000-man army. And 300 also has it right that because their kingdom is so big, They have cohorts of people from China, from India, who fight together, who train together, who have different fighting styles, who come and they will attack in waves anybody that they're going to seek to overthrow. Fascinating stuff. They also have this group called the 10,000 Immortals, which you also see represented in 300. This is a group of people who supposedly don't die. What actually happened was they would have these masks that would mark them out as the immortals, and when one of them die, another guy would put it on. So these guys just keep coming. Know what, you know? Oh, I thought I killed that guy already. No, yeah, there he is again. It works something like that, but it's terrifying on the battlefield. Absolutely terrifying. These guys keep coming. They never diminish. The group size stays the same. And you're like, how is this even happening? Persia also begins to use horses not just to get you to the battle, but in battle. I was watching Braveheart recently. If you want to know the power of a cavalry against a standing army, you can see Braveheart until they figured out how to take care of that. But they actually used horses, and so they had mounted soldiers. First time in human history that we know of. As I've already pointed out, as soon as the enemy would submit, they'd stop fighting, and they wouldn't kill them. And once they got the commander, and the commander, it wasn't like, well, you stood against us, and now somebody's going to pay. As soon as they became submissive, they brought him in, and then made him the king or the general of the army they were already running. It's like, all we're asking for is submission. We don't want domination. We don't want your goods. We don't want control. We just want you to acknowledge who we are and then just do your thing that you've been doing anyway. What they also established were what were called local satraps, and you'll see that word in the Bible occasionally. The satraps were essentially local governors and leaders. They're like, we've got a language barrier. We've got cultural barriers. We'll appoint a satrap that will learn our language, that will be a mediator between us, but we want your people ruling your people because history shows that's better than us trying to rule you and being all up in your business, which is where Rome gets some of their hierarchy of what we see in the New Testament. They said, you keep your culture, you dress the way that you want to, you worship the gods you want to, you sacrifice what you want to. Just be in submission and pay your taxes, and we'll leave you alone. Just do that. And that's how the Jews, get back to their place. Finally, what we find there, or almost finally, in Persia is an unusually for an ancient world. I mean, we read our own Bibles and the place of women, the Old Testament, and the place of women, and we cringe and struggle and think, what do we do with this? Persia, by and large, was not so. There was a significant cultural advancement within Persia, the Persian culture, of women in their dignity. Now, it's not universal. It's not, you know, it's not utopia. It's not romantic. But compared to all of the ancient cultures, there's an advancement of women in dignity and autonomy that was not known by Assyria or Babylon or even the Jews at this point. They were placed into leadership roles. They were allowed property ownership. They were able to conduct business when they have business meetings. They were brought into council meetings. They were given equal pay. And they just had a lot more influence than, again, anything on the radar in the ancient world. So what this leads us to is a kingdom that is really the first multicultural appreciation of all of the kingdoms and just a laissez-faire policy of if you can keep it together and you can pay your taxes, you have all the freedom you want. Just don't not pay us our taxes and don't rebel against us and everything will be fine. So what we find then is the establishment and support of local religions and beliefs, and they have a very high order of justice and equity within the laws that they built. They have some really impressive law codes. So the idea that this is just a pagan kingdom out of control and bloodthirsty and, you know, just doing it for their own good is just not the picture we get historically, unless you talk to Herodotus. He has a different perspective again. All right, so we're almost finished. So that brings us to the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. I hope that gives you some texture. This is kind of like the prologue, though much, much longer, of Lord of the Rings. It's like before you get to a hobbit in a hole, in Bag End, before you get to that, you got to know that there was a big battle, and that there was a ring that was forged, and that all these things happened, and there was this, you got to know that. That's what this week is the prologue to Ezra and Nehemiah. I hope it's not anticlimactic. But here's then where we get. So what we find is with all of this human culture, kingdoms, Cyrus, Zoroastrianism, all this stuff, you have this group of people who God had made a promise through Abraham, had brought out of Egypt, had brought into the land, who sinned against him, whose kingdom was overthrown, taken into exile. Now they're coming back to start over. And remember, all of that is God's punishment of them. He says that very clearly. I will punish you for your disobedience. Now they're coming back, and it's as if God is saying, I'm going to give you another shot at this. Let's see how you do. So it's a prophetic fulfillment. What we read in Ezra 1:1 is this. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, doesn't that just, now I know. You're welcome. Cyrus, king of Persia, wow. It's in that first year that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. The Lord, Yahweh, the God of Israel, stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. So the first theological thing that we find is even the sovereigns of the most massive nations of the world, God is moving in and directing and giving counsel and moving for his own purposes. You could look at Cyrus as a Jew and go, well, this doesn't show God's favor. He did this with everybody. You see, sometimes we say that, well, we know God's favor because he showed favor to me and not to this other person or something like that. But it's like the theological reading is, Cyrus is put there for this such a season as this. God put him there. So the shepherd saving Cyrus in the bassinet, so to speak, that was God preparing to bring his people back. Cyrus overthrowing his grandfather and his father. Cyrus overcoming Babylon. Cyrus having a principle of religious tolerance. What the writer tells us is that's God. That's Yahweh, the God of Israel, who is doing that and making a proclamation and putting it into writing. So he tells us specifically it's by the mouth of Jeremiah. Despite the fact that Israel's exile is due to her own sin, God shows himself as the promise keeper as revealed in the prophets. Specifically, he mentions here Jeremiah, Jeremiah 25. This whole land shall become a ruin and waste, speaking of Jerusalem and Judea. And these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then, after 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, the land of the Chaldeans, for their iniquity, declares the Lord, making the land an everlasting waste. He punishes Babylon by raising up Cyrus. And so when a pagan king overthrows another pagan king, it's the fulfillment of God's promise. As a matter of fact, Isaiah 44 makes this even more explicit. This is Yahweh who says of Cyrus, P.S., this is written before Cyrus is born, but he names him. He is my shepherd. This Zoroastrian king of kings of the greatest empire of the entire world up to that time, who reestablishes the Jews in their own kingdom, is the shepherd of the Lord. Put that in your theological pipe and smoke it. He shall fulfill all my purpose, saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of your temple, your foundation shall be laid. So long before Israel comes back into the land, long before Cyrus is born, God says, I'm going to raise up Cyrus, I'm going to bring you back into your land, and you will rebuild your temple. I'm going to put my rod down of punishment, and I will bless you again. So here's what we need to keep in mind as we come to Ezra and Nehemiah. There is this one commentator called the prophetic package of promise. When you go through, and you can go back through Tyler's Sunday School series, I'm sure, and collate this if he didn't make it explicit. But there's at least these several things. First, I will return you to your land. Once I take you into exile, I will return to your land. That's the first promise that he gives them. Second, the reestablishment of worship. Sacrifices will be made again. The temple will be rebuilt. Third, obedience to the law of God. Jeremiah 31. No one will say, "Know the Lord," for they will all know me, for the law will be written on their heart. Obedience. God, that's the fulfillment of God's promise. And then fourth, the coming of the nations to join Israel is a fourth promise. And a fifth promise is the enthronement of King David, or a ruler who is a descendant of David, who will rule over all the nations, who will be the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and they will voluntarily come to him to be ruled. That's the five parts of the prophetic package that we find in the prophets, which we bring to Ezra and Nehemiah and say, how is this going to go? Which of these are going to be fulfilled? Are all of them going to be fulfilled? Are some of them going to be fulfilled? Are none of them going to be fulfilled? I'm going to be returning to this idea of the prophetic package as we go through Ezra and Nehemiah and say, just what's going on here? Because it's clear, return to the land, according to the prophet Jeremiah. Reestablishment of worship, they build the temple. Obedience to the law of God, we're going to see that the law is reestablished, but then the question comes, how do they do with the law? Spoiler alert, read ahead and you'll already know. And then you won't have to come to any more sermons. So, books of Ezra and Nehemiah, very quickly. Originally considered one book by the Jews, later divided by the early church father Origen, and in the Latin Vulgate by Jerome. There are four important Persian leaders. I'll send out these notes if you can't write this fast. Four Persian leaders, Cyrus, Darius or Darius, Xerxes, which is also Ahasuerus of the Book of Esther, and Artaxerxes. Those are the four main leaders during this time period. There are three major periods. The first return of about 538 BC, about 50,000 people come back to Jerusalem. The second return under Ezra, and the returns of these exiles, and then the work of Nehemiah, which begins on the walls. And there you have the temple, the law, and the walls in those three phases. You have three major leaders, three major projects, three major troubles. You have Zerubbabel in the temple, gets resistance. You have Ezra in the law, there's resistance, but it's internal. You have Nehemiah and the wall, you have a problem, but it's both external and internal. And here's our one major question I want to leave us with this week. As these are written and told in reflection, what are the lessons the Jewish people are to learn? And then secondarily, how does this contribute to the big story of the coming of Jesus to the earth to fulfill the promises of God? It's the last stretch of Jewish history before Jesus. What is it intended to do? The authorship, very quickly, combination of official documents like the decree of Cyrus, lists of people that some of you will fall asleep with, various items of the temple, and genealogies. Yes, more genealogies, but you can see reestablishing right lineage for the priesthood as you come back in and build a temple is like super, you don't want any unholy hands touching the holy things. You got to include the genealogies. And then you have in both Ezra and Nehemiah personal memoirs where they actually kick into the first person. I did this, and when I prayed to the Lord, and I did this, but then it kicks into the third person. He did this, he did this, he did this. So we actually have somebody who's writing the history and including their personal memoirs. These two books have almost the most diverse array of documents in all of the Old Testament, and they're compiled together. So here's where we'll look at it. So season one, just one season of this, by the way. Episode one, prologue, setting the stage. That's really the pre-episode. Episode one, Zerubbabel in the temple. Episode two, Ezra and the law. Episode three, Nehemiah and the law. And then finally, episode four, the great letdown, spoiler alert. And then a postlude, now what? That's how I plan to handle the next several sermons. So concluding thoughts very quickly. What's clear in Ezra and Nehemiah, if you come away from it, all of this, is God is the covenant promise keeper. What he says, he will do. That's how Ezra 1:1 starts out, the promise that he made through Jeremiah the prophet. What he says he will do, he will do. What we see, secondly, is the Lord's sovereign movement of a human sovereign. He accomplishes his purpose by using people who don't worship him. And you can read Ezra and almost come away with like, man, I think Cyrus got saved. Nope. He's writing a letter to the Jews for the establishment of the God who dwells in Israel. That's it. It's very utilitarian. He didn't get saved. Any more than probably Nebuchadnezzar did in the book of Daniel. But God shows his sovereignty over him and moves him to accomplish his purposes. No one is too big. No one is too out of control. No one is so fulfilling their own purposes that God can't use them to fulfill his own purposes. So the Lord's sovereign movement. And what we're going to see, that's a theme in Ezra and Nehemiah. God moved in the heart of this leader and God moved in the heart of these people. What we see here is the mixed effects of God's work. As I mentioned earlier, the whole idea that, well, God showed favor to us and no one else, that's how we know it's his promise. We see God's work is a mixed work. He sends rain and sunshine on the just and the unjust. When he accomplishes his purpose, it's not nearly ordinarily as clean as we think it would be. Like, narrow and specific and focused. Like, he blessed a lot of other nations who were in exile at the exact time. And dare I say, he allowed the establishment of all of those false temples at the same time. I mean, could God have worked where Cyrus only had favor on only the Jewish people and only Yahweh religion? Yes, but he didn't. So the whole idea of, well, the government did this for Christians, but we know they did it for ulterior motives. And if it benefits us and is a blessing, it is a blessing. Well, it has these other repercussions that it does these other things. God seems to have been working that way for a long time. It's for us to receive with gratitude the gifts God gives us, no matter how mixed they may be. I've already mentioned the possible influence or at least interaction with the Hebrews and later Christian thought due to their experience in Persia. One example I give of this is in Isaiah 45. In Isaiah 45, we read this, and this is before the exile, remember. In Isaiah 45, verse 7. I form light and I create darkness. I make well-being and create calamity. I am Yahweh who does all these things. Here's a classic passage for the hyper-Calvinist or fatalist to say that all good and evil come from God. And we just go, don't know about that. That doesn't feel right. But then when you come to 1 John 1:5, in him is light, and there is no darkness whatsoever, we think, there seems to be some development here. He's the Father of lights with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. And we ask the question, in God's progressive revelation, what ideas were the Jews bumping up against and eventually the Christians to say, there's a development of revealed theology from God through text and circumstances that has helped them to know more about who God is over time. That's a risky thing. It's a little bit unnerving, but I think there may be something to it to at least ask that question. The next thing, the likelihood that the Magi were from Persia. I'm very convinced that from the East at that time period, and the word Magi is actually a Persian word, apparently. So the Magi were the wise men who were probably Zoroastrian and monotheistic, who believed in a single God, who probably had heard from, remember, not all the Jews come back from exile. Some of them stay in Persia. and heard about the promise of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords who is coming, the Son of David, and have enough revelation that they believe that there's one true God and that the King of the Jews is the one who will bring his kingdom and come in all the way from the east in order to see and to worship him. Again, an amazing thing when you compare the Persian Empire with this tiny group of people called the Jews in that region, in Palestine. So we'll close with the prophetic promise package. How much of it is fulfilled in Ezra and Nehemiah? How much of it remains to be fulfilled? And what is the author doing? And if there's anything unfulfilled, what remains as the antidote? And spoiler alert, the problem that remains undealt with is the issue of obedience and new hearts and Jesus, and who is the true king. And we're going to see that Ezra and Nehemiah has no king in it. The Son of David, king who will change the hearts of people, is the antidote to Ezra, Nehemiah, and its problems. All right, thank you for your patience. That was a ton of material, but I've been preparing this message for 3 weeks. So I'm still learning the discipline of exclusion, and next time it'll be more sermonic, as much as I can. Let's pray. Father, we marvel at the fact that you are the God of gods, that you are the true and the living God that works in the hearts of pagan rulers and kings, and the heart of the king is in your hand, not only the heart of the king of Israel, but also the heart of the king of Persia and all other kings and the kings of nations now, the leaders of the nations. And we accept with gratitude the good gifts that come to us, the favor that you show on us, the light and the blessings we receive, though they're often mixed. And Lord, we pray that you would help us to come into these books with anticipation, to know that ultimately the solution will be found in Jesus, that will turn and circumcise hearts and will change obedience to obedience out of love. So please bless us as we come to the table now, in Christ's name.